It's arguably the case that, as Carroll said in 1961, the purpose of language testing is always to render information to aid in making intelligent decisions about possible courses of action. I think this holds true whether the decisions are primarily pedagogic or if they affect the future of education or employment of the test taker. If fair and useful decisions are to be made, then three conditions really must hold. The first is that valid inferences must be made about the meaning of test scores. Second, score meaning must be relevant and generalizable to a real-world domain. And the third is that score meaning should be at least partially predictive of post-decision performance. Now, if any of these three conditions are not met, then the process of assessment and decision-making may be questioned. And that's not only in theory, but it also could be questioned in the courts. So it's not really surprising that historically testing practice has rested on the assumption that language competence, however we define it, is a relatively stable cognitive trait. Now, this is expressed most clearly for me in the classic statements of the role of measurement in human sciences. And I'm just going to quote one here, which is a very famous one from the American psychologist James McKean Cattell, who was writing in 1890. And this is what he said. "One of the most important objects of measurement is to obtain a general knowledge of the capacities of a man by sinking shafts, as it were, at a few critical points. In order to ascertain the best points for the purpose, the sets of measures should be compared with an independent estimate of the man's powers. We thus may learn which of the measures are the most instructive." And that's way back in 1890. Now, the purely cognitive conception of language proficiency that represents, and all human ability, is actually endemic to most branches of psychology and psychometrics. Now, this strong brand of realism assumes that variation in test scores is a direct causal effect of the variation of the trait within an individual. Now, this view of the world entails that any contextual feature that causes variation is really a contaminant that pollutes the score. And in the work of Messick, this is referred to as construct irrelevant variance. Now, the standardization of testing processes, from the presentation of the materials to the test takers to the administration of scoring, is really designed to minimize the impact of context on scores. So, again, referring to Carroll in his 1961 paper, he actually said, and I quote, "In some ways, a good test is like an experiment, in the sense that it must eliminate or at least keep constant all extraneous sources of variation. We want our test to reflect only the particular kind of variation in knowledge or skill that we are interested in at the moment." Now, that's a particularly interesting quotation because it really makes clear this point that anything to do with context or variation that's related to the context of the assessment is contamination. It is to be avoided at all costs. Now, there are also ethical and legal imperatives that encourage this approach to testing and assessment. If the outcomes of a test are high stakes, it's become incumbent upon the test provider to ensure that every test taker has an equal chance of achieving the same test score if they are of identical ability, assuming that we know what identical ability is, of course. Score variation due to construct irrelevant factors is, in the literature, termed bias. And if any test taker is disadvantaged by variation in the context of testing, and particularly if this is true of an identifiable subgroup of the test-taking population, then litigation is always possible. Language tests are therefore necessarily really abstractions from real life, and the degree to which that removal from real life takes place can often be very substantial. And of course we know that this is argued in the case of the multiple choice test, for example. And that abstraction is less distant in the case of performance-based simulations, where there is some attempt to introduce authentic situational materials to the performance. However, tests never reproduce the variability that is present in the real world. One analogy that I've used in the past to illustrate the problem of context is that of lifeguards and the test for a lifeguard. And it's impossible to reproduce all the conditions in which a lifeguard may have to operate. These could include weather conditions, swell in the water, currents, tides, the distance from the shore, the condition of the victim, and the victim's physical build. I mean, the list just goes on and on. It's potentially endless. What's more, health and safety regulations would preclude replicating many of the extremes that could occur within each of those facets. The solution is to list constructs that are theoretically related to the real-world performance. So in the case of the lifeguard example, that would be things like stamina, endurance, courage, and we could go on and list others. The test of stamina could be passive drowning of the victim, rescue and extraction from a swimming pool using an average weight and size model, is assumed to be generalizable to many, many different conditions that the lifeguard may face in real life. And the purpose of the test is to predict the ability of the test taker to successfully conduct rescues in non-pool domains. The strength of the relationship between the test and the real-world performance is then an empirical matter. And that's part of what we would do in a validation study. Now, recognizing the impact of context on test performance may initially look like a serious challenge to the testing enterprise. A score meaning must thereafter be constructed from much more than individual ability. Now, Tim McNamara, in a very famous essay published back in 1995, referred to starting to look at these issues of context in testing as opening Pandora's box, allowing all the plagues of the real world to infect the purity of the link between a score and the mind of the person from whom the score was derived, thinking back to, you know, Cattell kind of situation. Now, while this may be true, I mean, that kind of thinking of infecting and really making the score meaning impossible may be in a radical constructivist treatment of context be problematic for validation theory. But I believe that validation theory is capable of taking complex context into account while still maintaining score generalizability for practical decision-making purposes. Now, in the rest of this feature, what I'm going to do is I'm going to consider three stances towards context as they've been traditionally espoused in language testing. And these are, firstly, atomism, secondly, neo-behaviorism, and thirdly, interactionism. Now, this classification is familiar from other areas of applied linguistics, but in language testing, each has very distinctive implications. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to describe each, and then I'm going to discuss them under two subheadings. The first subheading is generalizability, and the second subheading is provlepsis. Now, generalizability is the more common term in language testing, and that's concerned with the breadth or the scope of score meaning beyond the immediate context of the test. In other words, just how far from the test can we say that the score meaning is generalizable and therefore meaningful. The second term, the provlepsis, is a Greek word, and I'm using it to refer to the precision with which a score user may use the outcome of a test to look into the future and make predictions about the likely performance of the test taker. So that's a little bit more specific than generalizability. It's the accuracy of the prediction that can be made. And then I'm going to conclude the feature by considering how it's possible to take context seriously within a field like language testing that by necessity must decontextualize to remain ethical and legal. An atomistic approach to language testing is reductionist in the sense that it attempts to account for language in terms of elements or smaller particles. When the term reductionism is used by applied linguists these days, it normally carries a pejorative connotation, especially within discussions of complexity theory that stress the near impossibility of listing, let alone quantifying, contextual variables. Reductionism is, nevertheless, essential to the scientific method. In 1662, Robert Boyle discovered that the pressure and volume of gas are inversely proportionate when temperature is held constant. By using mercury to compress air in a J-tube under experimental conditions, he established one of the best-known constants in science. Away from the laboratory, the law has informed the invention of aerosols, tires, aqualungs, fridges, drinks cans, and syringes, to name just a few examples. Studying gas in its natural environment would not have produced a generalizable understanding of how gas works. Once a theory had been developed based on a small number of variables, predictions could be made about how gas would behave in other settings. And these predictions can be tested, which is what makes the theory scientific. Now, atomism implies a dualist view of the world. Gas may exist within context, but it has a separate and essentially unrelated identity and behaviour. Practically, when I purchase a new fridge, I expect it to keep my food fresh, whether I put it in the garage or in my kitchen. Whether I have a detached house or a flat, whether I live in the town or the countryside, if the context affected the performance of the fridge, I would suspect the science upon which the fridge was constructed. Now, a test that operates in a context-free way must target a single construct, such that the items selected for inclusion are homogeneous indicators of its presence or strength. And this kind of thinking goes back to researchers like Lovinger in her 1957 paper, a very famous piece of work on validity theory. Multiple choice is therefore the preferred item type in atomistic theories, or at least have been for the last 100 years, written to rules that avoid the possibility of arriving at a correct answer for different reasons. The technologies of item and distractor analysis have evolved to make multiple choice items the most researched and understood of all task types. Now let's turn to generalizability. The atomistic approach has been referred to as discrete point testing. Because of the focus on single elements of the language in isolation from contexts of use. This strategy of discrete point testing was deliberate because, as Lardo said in his 1961 book, Language Testing, and I quote, "The situations in which language is the medium of communication are potentially almost infinite, and that these can't be replicated in a test situation that does not specifically test language elements." You've got to test language elements to exclude the context and therefore to have some kind of effective testing. Within this approach, it's therefore argued that sampling language elements is practically more efficient and theoretically more valid than observing a limited contextualized performance. Now, the validation issue here is one of the extent to which we can generalize from the responses to decontextualize items to language knowledge and use outside of the test context. The argument is that good theory leads to reductionism, and reductionist solutions actually are more economic and efficient because they're generalizable beyond the immediate context. In this context, I'm going to another quote from someone called Cattell, but a different Cattell this time, someone working in the 1940s and early 1950s. And this Cattell was actually British, the other one was American. This Cattell was working actually in the town where I live, Leicester. He was an education advisor to the local education authority. And this is what he said: "Particularized validation is not only devoid of proper scientific interest, but deceptive in its promise of practical economy. Its absurdity is most cogently argued by the demands of practical economy and efficiency alone. For a specific test for every occupation and life situation is its logical and impossible conclusion." I suppose here the argument is, to understand how a clock works, you actually have to take the back off and look at what makes it tick. I suppose that one of the enduring empirical findings from language testing research is that discrete tests of grammar are the best predictors of performance on all other test types. So, Alan Davis in 1978 actually wrote a summary of this evidence. And this is what he said about it, and I think it's as true today as when Davis wrote this in 1978. And here's the quotation: "What remains a convincing argument in favour of linguistic competence tests, both discrete point and integrative, is that grammar is at the core of language learning. Grammar is far more powerful in terms of generalizability than any other language feature. Therefore, grammar may still be the most salient feature to test." Now, anyone listening to this may decide that that's not true. You may take argument with that, in which case it's well worth going back to that quotation by Davis and thinking about whether or not it's still true and discussing this. I now turn to the second of my two criteria under which I'm discussing these approaches, and that's provlepsis. The question still remains whether testing individual language elements can lead to a large class of real-world decisions. Now, there are some language testers who call these language elements facilitators, and that there are task types. For example, the repetition of syntactically acceptable sentences, sentence building from jumbled words, or the calculation of response latencies, for example, that these can predict scores on more contextualized performance measures. Now, in this case, correlational evidence is presented to support this atomistic psycholinguistic approach to testing. Now, if the argument is accepted, atomism provides both generalizability and almost infinite provlepsis to any context of use. However, I would argue that this is an example of the correlational fallacy, because evidence suggests that even if high correlations can be established between tests of language elements and scores awarded on performance tests, decisions about future performances in specific domains are insecure. Now, the first person to argue this was actually Colfers in 1944. And this was done on the basis of making decisions about the performance of military personnel in the field during the Second World War. Now, the use of scores to make criterion reference decisions, like the military domain, it seems to me, requires the specification of domains of use, because language is configured by the communicative purpose it serves. So while analysis of the minutiae of language elements is a valuable scientific enterprise in its own right that generalizes to language competence, there is no guarantee that we can predict language use in a very specific domain. Now, let me give you an example of this, which is a very blunt one. I would not wish to certify an air traffic controller as communicatively safe to practice on the basis of his or her ability to manipulate verb morphology. Now, this kind of problem that I'm identifying is really expressed very well in the classic paper on criterion referencing by Glaser and Klaus, which was published in 1962. And this was their classic articulation of criterion reference testing. And here's a quotation from that paper. "The adequacy of a proficiency test depends upon the extent to which it satisfactorily samples the universe of behaviors which constitute criterion performance. In this sense, a test instrument is said to have content validity. The greater the degree to which the test requires performance representative of the defined universe, the greater is its content validity." Now, you can see probably where I'm coming from this. I think that atomistic approaches are scientifically justifiable and are generalizable in the sense that we need to take the back off the clock. We have to have language theories which help us understand how language works. And therefore, from a research perspective, are totally legitimate. But when we wish to make predictions to specific domains, the atomistic approach doesn't actually cut it. This section is on neo-behaviorism. The attack on atomism came from the communicative language testing movement, and it was particularly fierce. Lauder's use of discrete items to test language elements was really ruthlessly savaged, and in the revolution that followed, as it was so called at the time, authenticity became the principal criterion by which tests were judged. The use of this term authenticity implied that a test taker must communicate a message for a recognized purpose, and that input and prompts should be drawn from beyond the world of language teaching and testing, and a rich context should be provided. The definition of context included specification of the physical environment, participant status, and levels of formality, among other things. The most complex attempt to define authenticity to date is that of Bachman and Palmer in their 1996 book, which lists the features of the target language use domain, or the TLU domain, which they claimed could be used to replicate real-life context in test tasks. And their model of the target language use domain has been used very extensively in language testing since the publication of their book. The most extreme manifestation of neobehaviorism is actually in the theory of variable competence, which states that speakers do not possess a heterogeneous language ability at all, but only a capability to use language that is realized differentially by every facet of every context of use. Unlike atomism, which has a dualist view of the world, neobehaviorism implies a monist view of the world. There's no distinction at all between context and construct. And each context is unique because it is generated by an unreproducible matrix of contextual facets. So all meaning is rendered local, and the most that can be expected is that we describe each context in as much detail as possible and collect the descriptions into a compendium that reflects the unimaginably complex variation that exists in the world. Now, when this approach is combined with radical constructionism, human identity is sucked into the matrix along with language. So any sense of the self or of durable language competence, whose performance is an expression of that self, is replaced by a variably context-bound, constructed identity that is a dynamic, and this is a quotation actually from a writer from this perspective, a dynamic discursive construction and a site of struggle. And what this means is that everything is contextually bound. There is nothing that exists outside of context. So in testing terms, each act of testing is a singularity which constructs the test taker, their language, the construct, and the score meaning. This is completely different from the atomism, where the person is first and the language comes first, and the context is something that has to be controlled. Let us consider generalizability, the first of our two criteria. Each act of speaking or of performance within a test is unique. Now, one writer, Elaine Tyrone, understands the matter here quite clearly when she asserts the following. She says, and I quote here, "The most obvious point here is that testers will need to interpret their test results as applying to very restricted TLU situations and testing conditions. The nature of the L2 oral construct itself may be viewed as context-specific, shifting from task to task." Now, this rabbit hole runs very, very deep indeed, because if there is no underlying competence, merely variable competence or capability, then all we see is all there is. There is nothing else to see. We would never be able to generalize from one task to another, from a test situation to another test, or from one classroom exercise to another. Because no context can be replicated precisely. Each is unique. And so we're not able to make any meaningful inferences about the participants or their ability to communicate beyond saying, that is what they did in this unique act of language use. And so by the admission of the neobehaviorists themselves, generalizability is completely impossible. What about provlepsis? Well, apart from the uncontrolled mass of unanalyzable and uncomparable data collected in the compendium of unique acts of language use, we are completely unable here to generate any knowledge that we can use to see into the future. The irony here is that by abolishing everything but context, context is done away with as well. It's kind of the Nietzschean paradox par excellence. And I think Lyle Bachman understands this in his writing. He wrote a wonderful paper on inference in language testing. And this is what Bachman says about this. And this is my quotation. If the researcher adopts a monist ontology, then the notion of context becomes largely irrelevant, since the observer, the entity or construct to be described, induced or explained, and the context are all part of the same phenomenon or reality, and it makes little sense to try to delineate where one ends and the other begins. Well, I agree with Bachman here. It's all much of a muchness. The only value for language testing in neo-behaviorism generally, and constructionism in particular, is the attention that's paid to the detail in the qualitative analysis of performance data. And I have to say that neo-behaviorists do this exceptionally well. But that's partly because the real agenda here is ideological rather than analytical or practical. The attack on individual identity as well as durable constructs really reveals this post-structuralist program. It's the view that all language constructs are political in nature, and therefore the only way to address the issue of validation is to look at the way tests are used and constructed within an understanding of the political and policy context of language test use. Now, there's nothing wrong with that in itself. The study of language test use and the policy context is a legitimate area for investigation. But within a neo-behaviorist approach, it does away with all meaningful prediction from test scores to context. Indeed, I would argue that we are no longer individuals capable of communicating our needs, desires, and innermost thoughts with others of our language-using species. Rather, within neo-behaviorist approaches, we are constructs of a matrix, which is designed by political institutions for their purposes. It is a site of struggle that binds us to the present, and it in fact robs us not only of the ability to make decisions about likely future communicative success of test takers, but it also robs us of the test takers themselves. So apart from the value that we get in the qualitative analysis of performance data from this particular approach, I would argue that this radical approach to context actually does away with the notion of context itself and is of very, very little practical value in language testing and assessment. If an awareness of context simply means that we say different things to different people in different situations, then quite honestly it's a truism that we've always known. And it really doesn't need problematizing in the way that it is in neo-behaviorism. Research into the contextual variables that impact on test taker behavior and score variation in speaking tests, for example, has identified systematic effects of concern. And quasi-experimental research has manipulated individual pragmatic variables, such as power, imposition, and social status, to monitor individual changes in discourse by L1 background. However, purpose of all these studies is either, firstly, to identify variation that can be defined as part of the construct and therefore can be incorporated into test design specifications and scoring models, or Two can be classified as construct irrelevant variants, uncontrolled. Now, an example of the former is ongoing research to operationalize the new construct of interactive competence. And an instance of the latter is research into the use of, for example, interlocutor frames to standardize the level of scaffolding provided in speaking tests. So in the first case, it's construct relevant variants because it's part of the definition of interaction. And in the latter case, it's construct irrelevant because it's the issue of whether or not some test takers get more help from an interlocutor than others would. The research is therefore an investigation into how things actually are in the real world of individuals communicating with other individuals in a variety of social contexts. Just like atomism, interactional approaches to context are dualistic. Individuals are assumed to have abilities that are real in the sense that they have duration, and they're independent of the thoughts or theories of language testers. How language competence is realized in use is nevertheless influenced by the context in which the language is used. And it's in this sense that there is interaction between individuals, their enduring but evolving competence, and observable phenomena and observable performances. Now, acknowledging variability in an interactionist paradigm, even within specified domains, isn't inherently problematic for language testing. It's achieved in many other assessment fields with even larger scales and variation and less clarity in the criteria for assessment. And I'm just going to give you one example in which that's the case. In 1978, a guy called Robert Parker decided to start rating wines on a 50 to 100 point scale. And that practice has endured and supported the growth of a multi-billion dollar wine trade industry. More recently, wine websites have asked enophiles to taste a specific vintage in their own homes or in some other environment of their choice, presumably a restaurant, specifically to introduce contextual variation. And when someone does that, their ratings of that wine are uploaded to a website, seller tracker, and the wine receives an aggregated rating. Now, the skeptic can amass a range of evidence against the usefulness of this activity, including variation in the taste of individual wine tasters. And we also know that expectations impact on rating, including price information or the environment in which the wine is served. Similarly, research shows that when context is removed completely in double-blind wine tasting experiments, expert tasters actually give very different ratings. Now, although the readers of magazines like Wine Enthusiast and Wine Spectator know all this about the ratings are still taken seriously as a guide to the quality of wines, and the ratings affect pricing and purchasing volume. Now, one reason for the success of these wine ratings is that people are generally happy with the idea that a number can act as an index, however inaccurate that may be, of what something is worth. This is why we're asked to rate everything from our shopping experience on the internet to the service in the hotel we stayed at last week. The fact of the matter is, we live in a metroscape with rules that everyone implicitly understand. The rules are based on Laplace's central limit theorem, which state that the probability that the sum of a large number of independent random factors will take a particular value is normally distributed. Now, for wine tasting, the more ratings that are accumulated, the more random contextual variance is taken into account in arriving at the final score. This is how we gain control over unimaginably complex variation. What we do is we introduce yet more random variation into the process. This critical insight into the value and use of randomness was first formulated by C.S. Peirce and one of his students, Jastrow, in a paper that was published way back in 1885. And they randomized weights and the sequence in which different weights were given to participants in order to discover if they were able to detect very small differences in the weights between different objects. And without this insight about randomization, today we wouldn't have effective drug trials or other critical research that continually improves our lives by delivering systematic outcomes, irrespective of context. Relating back to what I said earlier, your fridge works as promised wherever you put it. Chances are that you will like a wine with a rating of 95, whether you drink it in the garden or in the dining room. And if you hire an international health professional with a grade A or B on the occupational English test, they're highly likely to be able to communicate with patients. Now, in language testing, as in wine tasting, the certainty with which we interpret score meaning increases when we maximize the tasks, that's tastings or observations, and the scores, that's tasters or raters. In pilot studies, it is possible to vary the number of tasks and raters to discover the optimal mix for an operational language test. But in live testing, we cannot accumulate the same number of ratings as the Seller Tracker website does. We therefore have to be much more circumspect in our data collecting. Now, let's look at this again in terms of my two categories, generalizability and provlepsis. Start with generalizability. If we treat the test as a data collection tool, the technology that is used to design the tool for a particular purpose is the test specification. The specification first sets out how observational data is converted to a summary score. It describes in as much detail as possible the range of tasks that might appear in any form of a test, and how these tasks are permitted to vary along construct-relevant facets. For example, if I wish to make an inference to a test taker's ability to recognize speaker status and then change level of formality accordingly, the variable speaker status must be allowed to vary over specified parameters. In some tests of academic English, this is done through tasks involving peer discussions, tutorials with academic staff, and service encounters, say in the accommodation office or in the medical centre. Similarly, the specification controls those facets that are not relevant to the intended inferences. For example, any requests that are made in these contexts are restricted to low-level impositions on the grounds that we have discovered differential performance by L1 background in high-level but not low-level imposition tasks. I have previously described this role of test specifications as the control and freedom mechanism that manages the complexity of contextual effect on score variation. So we control the generalizability we want through the test specification by freeing the parameters on the test to things we want to generalize to, and by controlling those things that we think would act as construct-irrelevant variants. So we can actually control the generalizability through the test specification. Let's turn to provlepsis. The extent to which test scores provide information about a possible future depends on how well the specifications articulate the tasks and constructs of interest and manipulate the control and freedom possible to represent the language use expected in the domain to which inferences are being drawn. Now, in the case of academic English, this may be achieved through a thorough description of the context and nature of language use in higher education. Now, the long tradition of domain-specific analysis to inform test design is incorporated into criterion referenced assessment. And that in turn goes back to the very earliest tests for job-specific selection. So there's actually a very long history of being able to do this. In traditional approaches to language testing and educational measurement more generally, a criterion has been interpreted as either another test of the same construct or as some kind of standards document to which tests are mapped. But these are technical definitions that actually subvert the meaningful validation processes in which the criterion of criterion-referenced assessment is the language use domain of interest. There's an implicit requirement that the domain informs test design and development, rather than the creation of an instrument for which validation is little more than a post hoc activity to support the permissive inferences that a prospective user may wish to make. Although I've talked about three approaches, they occupy a climb from, on the one hand, atomism, through interactionism, to the other extreme of neo-behaviorism. And so I think I can say quite safely that there are two extreme responses to the complexity of context that language testers have had to grapple with. Lardo's answer was to remove context from the language test completely. And this wasn't really because Lardo was an atomist, because much of Lardo's writing, if you go back, and I think everyone should go back and read his 1961 book, much of his writing is concerned with the expression of culture through language, the primacy of speech, and the use of language to achieve higher values, such as tolerance towards minorities and cross-cultural understanding. And that was Lardo's writing in that particular context is absolutely wonderful. I mean, it's a beautifully written book, but the overwhelming sense that meaning transmission in language is so complex led to the reductionist solution that Lardo opted for, and that came under such criticism in just decades, within 2 decades of writing the book. The second extreme response is evident in some uses of complexity theory in modern applied linguistics and social science research. And this is the complete rejection of our ability to identify and control key variables that cause contextual variation. For many people, dealing with context can be like looking out into the vastness of space. It's boundless and represents infinite potentiality. It's a place where there's simply no escape from the expanse that faces us, and any choice regarding direction just seems meaningless. And as we know, in space, no one can hear you scream. And I call this the Keverberg principle. You see, and I'll explain that in a moment, the primary problem with an unfettered interest in a myriad of possible factors that interact to produce a unique outcome is that we're unable to generate generalizable knowledge that leads to prolepsis. The result is that we are unable to make any predictions at all about future success from current performance. So, what's the Keverberg principle? Now, in the early days of census taking in Europe, it was argued that the ratio of population to births could be arrived at by segmenting a country into sampling frames, taking a sample from each frame and dividing the number of births by sample total. The idea was akin to that of modern cost-effective random sampling in polls or surveys to produce a result that's independent of local circumstances or context. Now, Keverberg objected to this method, and he argued that the only solution was to conduct a complete census of every person in the country on a particular day. And he applied the same argument to births as to deaths. And I'm just going to read you a quick quotation from Keverberg's writing on this, which was published in 1827, because it gives a real insight into this, his sense that this is just so complex that you just have to look at absolutely everything in its unique context. Here's the quotation. "The law regulating mortality is composed of a large number of elements. It is different for towns and for flatlands, for large opulent cities and for smaller and less rich villages, and depending on whether the locality is dense or sparsely populated. This law depends on the terrain, raised or depressed, on the soil, dry or marshy, on the distance to sea, near or far, on the comfort or distress of the people, on their diet, dress, and general manner of life, and on a multitude of local circumstances that would elude any a priori enumeration. There would seem to be infinite variety in the nature, the number, the degree of intensity, and the relative proportion of these elements." Now you can see, that's almost a statement of complete abandonment, of being just overwhelmed by the sheer complexity of the situation. Applied sciences, like meteorology, on the other hand, model complex systems in order to improve prolepsis. In a sense, the purpose of understanding complexity is to simplify it, and to simplify it to the extent that we're able to use the information to solve problems. Keverberg's understanding of this situation is never going to solve the problem in any practical manner. Now, meteorology has successfully created complex models, and as it's done that, short-term forecasting of the weather has become more accurate, and the limitations on longer-term forecasting has become more evident. Now, as Klein states, accurate, repeatable numerical measurement or quantification is a constant objective, even in areas where it is not yet fully achieved. Now, let me go back to my examples from earlier. Wine tasting and language testing aspire to this objective in the full knowledge that what is being measured does not have the same status as natural phenomena. Any such presumption would be to commit an error of reification. Nor can wine tasting or language testing pretend that score distributions represent the notion of error in any meaningful sense. Social sciences are contingent in far too many ways for the kind of certainty that we get in natural sciences. But, just like meteorology, we're able to create useful models or abstractions that help us do useful things. Now, I'm arguing that there's a place for both atomism and interactionism in language testing and research, depending upon the kind of inferences that we wish to make about the test taker. In research, it's also important to study systems in action to see how the components of the system contribute to its usefulness. And this improves both generalization and prolepsis. Now, I'm going to introduce here another example taken from another discipline, and I hope this will support the argument I'm putting forward. At the University of Salford in the United Kingdom, research is being undertaken to look at how energy is expended in standard three-bedroom properties, depending on a range of contextual factors. And of course, the purpose is to produce houses that are more energy efficient. Now, it would be impossible to do this using the kind of natural research that's currently in vogue in applied linguistics. In naturalistic research, houses might be visited across the country and measurements taken of outside weather conditions, the state of the boiler, inside temperature, levels of insulation, air pressure, humidity, and so on. And these could be correlated with heat loss. And we could go even further. Let's make this really complex. Let's add to the model construction materials, type of glass in the windows, the colour of the paint, which may reflect heat, numbers of occupants, that's body heat, thickness and construction of foundations. I think you see where this is going. The list is potentially endless. And very soon, the n sizes you would need for essentially what is a correlational fishing trip would just become mind-bogglingly large and uneconomically feasible. It's just like the Keverberg principle all over again. It is too complex to manage. A natural response to the problem, therefore, is just to throw our hands up and say it's all far too complex. But that's not so. The solution is to create a model that simplifies the problem to reasonable proportions. Now, the engineering team at Salford have created an energy house inside an experimental building. Each contextual variable that might have an effect on heat loss is given freedom to vary within specified ranges, while those that are not theoretically presumed to be relevant are controlled, just as we would do in language testing with a test specification. The interaction of the contextual factors may also be studied to produce a complex model of the causes of heat loss. The model allows generalization to other houses and extrapolation to the real world, where particular configurations are predicted to be effective in the environment where the house is to be built. Now, recall right from the beginning of what I was saying, Carroll's view that a language test is like an experiment. Now, in an interactionist view, the action of designing and piloting a language test finds a very close analogy in the Energy House project. Both situations are very far from naturalistic, but they provide generalizable knowledge that is valuable and make the critical task of provlepsis possible. The only way to understand and use context is actually to simplify and control it. When Robert Boyle wished to discover what it was about air that was relevant to our understanding of the then newly discovered circulation of the blood, he created a vacuum to find out what would happen to candles and mice when air was not present. And Bachmann, to quote Bachmann again, was also correct when he wrote, "Context is a comfortable, albeit slippery term in applied linguistics. We all use the term and know what it means, yet we don't all agree on precisely what, where, or even when it is. What we are agreed upon is that it is important. In language testing, it is essential to establish which aspects of context impact upon learner performance and score variation. The effects must be classified as construct relevant or irrelevant. If they're relevant, then they are free to vary within certain parameters in the specifications. And if they are irrelevant, they must be controlled. Not all contextual factors are relevant. Theory suggests which should be the focus of research and which may safely, at least for the present, be left to one side. If the problem is not manageable, our research is useless." Sam Messick, in his 1989 paper, Validity, provides really good advice on this. And here's my quotation from Messick. "On the one hand, the impact of contextualization can be compelling because the very nature of a task might be altered by the operation of constraining or facilitating factors in the specific situation. On the other hand, we know that the use of multiple task formats, along with the standardization of testing conditions, contributes to convergent interpretations and comparability of scores across respondents and settings. Rather than opt for one position or the other, we urge that the role of context in test interpretation and test use be repeatedly investigated or monitored as a recurrent issue. Thus, the extent to which a measure displays the same properties and patterns of relationships in different population groups and under different ecological conditions becomes a pervasive and perennial empirical question. Now, my argument in this feature is that rather than opt for one position or the other, we opt for both. Every test has a purpose that requires context to be modelled anew and operationalised for assessment in an environment that is remote from the complexity of real-world contexts. But this in itself is both natural and desirable. Our task in testing is to create instruments to collect data and generate scores sufficient to support inferences about future performance, what I have called prolepsis. When contextual features are construct relevant, they require modelling, but we must avoid tests in which, as Latham says, the special circumstances under which they are placed tell, as we have seen, to the advantage of some as compared with others, for construct irrelevant reasons. So for each new purpose and domain of inference, empirical research is needed to justify the assessment systems and how we model context, because how we do it will change the lives of all the people who take our tests.